tonight is going to be a little different than the subsequent classes. So after this, we will be getting into, if you will, kind of the teachings themselves. So next week, I think, is Four Noble Truths, and then we have Eightfold Path and, you know, that kind of stuff. Or maybe next week is, I think, the Three Marks. It says on the website, and we'll be sending it out. But tonight, I wanted to kind of give the context of the Buddha and the spiritual and religious and social environment into which he was born, what he realized and how it built on and compared to the existing and other spiritual traditions of his time. And it might seem a little historical or philosophical at times. That may be like, yay, we got somebody who's like, yay. You know, for some folks, it's a little like, you know, how is this relevant to my, you know, my everyday practice? We'll definitely, as we're going through the teachings, we will be talking about, you know, what does this mean to our practice? In terms of this, I feel like the context can give us greater appreciation for the arising of Buddhism and for the Buddha himself. And there's also a way that, in terms of like comparative religion, sometimes you can learn something about a religion or a whatever, a discipline, by kind of comparing it, not in a terms of evaluation, better or worse, but say, you know, how is it different? What are the different premises? You can actually start to understand it better through comparison. And I also think it's valuable to know those of us who are students of Buddhism, most of us not coming from a culture that was, you know, Buddhist by history, to know what Buddhism shares with the religious and cultural traditions that it arose at the same time as. So that you kind of know, there may be some things that you think are Buddhist, which it's not that they're not Buddhist, but they're not exclusively Buddhist. Actually, like lots of stuff that came from the thoughts of ancient India. So just to set the stage. So when Buddhism arose around 500 BCE in north central India, there was already an ancient civilization there. And I'm going to say Myoju. So you're by Jain by birth. So, and you've studied more of this than I have in terms of history. So if I say anything wrong, just I'm not going to do, you know, put the burden on you. But please feel free.
The thing is, I keep forgetting what I learned. So I'm so glad to.
Because I'm going to talk about Jainism, and if I just. This is a lot of what I learned from history. I'm not a scholar of history. I just read it in a book. So, you know, it's not the strongest kind of knowledge. Anyway, so it was an ancient civilization already in India. So the Indus Valley civilization lasted for about 1,000 years and had, well-developed culture and religion and cities. It ends up declining around 1700 BCE, and there may be various reasons for that, but that's about the time that nomadic people called the Aryans were coming to the area, and that's just what they called themselves. They did have lighter skin than the native peoples, but it didn't until more recently become allied with a term for a race. So they're the Aryans. Eventually, they came to dominate. One of the theories is that's because they had battle chariots. And with them, they brought a fully formed religion and a three-part system of hereditary social classes. So the priests, warriors, and cultivators. And this eventually evolved into the four-part caste system, which was established in India and remains to some extent today. So there's the Brahmins or priests, priestly caste, the warrior or ruler caste, the merchant or landowner caste, and the Shudra or laborer caste. So they brought with them the highly developed religion with a pantheon of gods, kind of like the Greek and Roman, you know, but colorful gods with stories and agendas. So they didn't have the, you know, the all-powerful, omniscient god of monotheism. And we know about the Aryan religion because of the religious texts they composed called the Vedas. And Veda meant knowledge. And this collection of texts included mythical stories of the gods and hymns to their praise, as well as instructions for elaborate rituals and philosophical treatises. So it's a vast body of work composed between about 1500 BCE and 600 BCE. So, and over time, what evolved in India was Vedic, they call it Vedic Brahmanism. So it emphasized a cosmic law governing the whole universe. And that includes gods, nature, humankind. And the Vedic ritual reflected and harnessed that cosmic law. And in a way that, so this kind of went over from just like appeasing the gods, you know, doing something to appease them so you could might be able to earn their favor, to a certain kind of sense that the Brahmins, the priests, if they were doing this ritual properly, they could harness or tap into or reflect this cosmic law and actually kind of make stuff happen. Like there was a power to the ritual. You might actually be able to coerce a god, for instance, into doing something. So the Brahmins had their great ritual power, and they were the only ones that could do these rituals and do these priestly things. And so if you think, you know, your well-being relies on it, then you can see why the Brahmins
had... Can I just say something?
Yeah, yeah.
So the Aryans came from the steppes of Russia. So when they came southwards to India, a branch of them went into Europe, and that's where the Hitler Aryans come. So it's the same thing. We have the swastika too, but it's turned backwards. Uh-huh. And if you look at the language, for example, in Latin and Sanskrit, there's a lot of similar words. The grammar is exactly the same, yeah. But the words too, like...
Which is why we say the Indo-European languages, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So Pitta, we say Pitta for father, Pater, Mata, Pater, Rata, brother. I mean, it's amazing how much similarity there is. Right between the Indo-Europeans. I just wanted to say that there's a connection.
Yeah.
And when the Aryans came to India, that we had the local Dravidians, they were darker skinned, the local people, who they then pushed to the south of India, and they kind of, you know, were superseded. They were more like pagans, they were, you know, they didn't believe in the. So it was.
Yeah. It's very. Fascinating,
yeah.
Fascinating history, and it was so cool to visit India and be in a place where like just human history went back that far, and in an unbroken way.
Yeah.
It's just been a continual evolution, mishmash movement. Like it's just wow. So Vedic Brahmanism then was also very concerned with what's called orthopraxy, or rules for correct liturgical or ethical conduct. So, and in particular then, depending on what kind of caste you were born into, you had certain obligations. And fulfilling those obligations and living according to them was part of how you, I don't know, did they believe that you got reborn into heaven or something? Or... Because this was predates the really spread of the theory of transmigration. So I don't know what, before this theory of transmigration, they thought happened. I don't know. Anyway, well.
it's funny, the word dharma comes from them. So if you lived according to your caste, the way you're supposed to, you're fulfilling your dharma. The Buddha, of course,
Right. So then there was a great period of social and economic change. So around like 800 to about 500 BCE. Mm-hmm. So they figure the Iron Age technology appeared. They were able to clear larger tracts of land for agriculture. Productivity increased with the plow. So then fewer people had to farm. So you have emergent, you know, merchant classes and kind of a middle class and increased trade. Everybody's life standards probably went up a little bit, no matter where you are on the spectrum. So traditional tribal structures started to break down. Age-old reverence for older forms of authority were questioned. So this is a kind of a common theme in cultures throughout history. When things start to mix up, then new ideas start to appear and you start to question the old order. And previously, Northern India was divided into smaller clans or tribes ruled by their own, you know, aristocratic elite. But then ambitious kings started acquiring armies and absorbing the tribes around them. So then they consolidated power. So it's one interesting statement said, count by 500 BCE, around the time of the Buddha, countless tribes and clans in central and northwestern India had been incorporated into approximately 16 city-states. So it was definitely not, you know, united in one thing, but it was consolidated into these city-states. So things were different. So even in the Vedic tradition, new things start to arise, which the Upanishads were created around this time. And these, they called their practice Vedanta, or the end of the Veda, kind of the culmination of the Veda. And so there's lots of like really different stuff appears in the Upanishads than had appeared in the Vedas before. So here's some themes that may be familiar to you if you've studied this at all. So there exists a unity or oneness out of which everything arose, which is referred to as Brahman, not Brahmin as in priest, but Brahman, with a capital B. And within the person is a true self called an Atman, which at advanced levels of spiritual mastery, one realizes is identical with Brahman. We think we're separate, but we're not. That apparent duality is, in a certain sense, illusory. Spiritual and inner sacrifice matters as much, if not more, than material or outer sacrifice. And spiritual knowledge and understanding were more important than external behaviors. Particularly, and this is where it's kind of a reaction to that, the Vedic Brahmanism, particularly the enactment of ritual and other orthopraxy. So there was this kind of shift into more of the spiritual, if you will, emphasis. So there's some tension in there, but it's just interesting that there was this, I'm going to talk about new religions and spiritual traditions that arose, but even within the Vedic tradition, the new things were arising. And then also first appearing in the Upanishads was this doctrine of transmigration, this sense that after death we are reborn into this world, that there's some essence or soul that somehow goes into an embryo or fetus and takes life again. So this doctrine spread between the 700s and 500s BCE and had a profound impact on almost all native Indian religious traditions. So I feel like I could, you know, somebody could probably study just this their whole life. It's just such a fascinating, you know, why did this arise and why did it become, by the time Buddhism arose, it was like kind of the background understanding. This is just how the world worked, is that this cycle of transmigration. So previously, most religious traditions had believed in some kind of permanent afterlife condition. You die and then you get to go somewhere, go off with the ancestors or something like that. So first, this was an esoteric tradition or teaching for advanced disciples, but that like spread, and as it spread, it took on a kind of a pessimistic air that this was kind of like a trap, that you'd just kind of be born over and over. Everything you gain will be lost, and then you'll just have to start all over again. You know, unless you're a spiritual adept, everything you learned, you'll forget, and you'll have to start over. So ignorance means you repeat your mistakes. Even if you're very fortunate in this life, in the next life you could be really miserable. And there's just this sense that it could go on, it just goes on infinitely. And I don't know about you, but I find it difficult for me to see this that pessimistically. I mean, I don't see it optimistically. I don't believe in rebirth or transmigration anyway. But if it was true, I don't know. I mean, if you think about it, like, what if it really was true? Would that be a good thing or bad thing? I don't know. I mean, in one sense, people think like, well, you just kind of live forever then, right? But if you don't know, you just, every time, you just kind of like, yay, I'm going to figure it out. Oh, then, you know, you lose everything and die, and then you're born. I mean, there's that kind of sense of hopes dashed repeatedly, losing everything repeatedly. I don't know. I think depending on different times in our life, we can imagine looking at that positively, and at certain times, certain more kind of depressed or despairing times, we could see where that would feel very negative. But in any case, you know, some of the theories about why this doctrine arose and impacted so much of the spiritual thinking, you know, was it that existential unease due to social upheaval? Was it a deliberate departure from the Brahminical tradition somehow? I guess some historians, is an idea from the lower classes that caught on with the elite. But my favorite theory, the one that just seems to make some sense to me, is that this also coincided with the birth of Indian astronomy. And they were starting to get a sense of just the cyclic nature, the vastness of the universe, and the cyclic nature of things. And I think I just kind of thought, oh my God, it just kind of repeats itself. Everything just repeats itself. And I don't know. So by the time Buddhism arose, like I said, this was widely assumed to be the way the world worked. And I would say that this way of looking at things helped spark these new religious traditions like Buddhism. But just, I would say, I don't see the belief in that is not necessary to Buddhism. And I think, I don't know if you know of, is it Stephen Batchelor, the secular Buddhism? He has a couple books on secular Buddhism, and he really, because there are certain Buddhist traditions that this is very central, like Vajrayana, for instance, like rebirth is very central to the whole idea. I feel like, you know, what is there in our essential teachings that's dependent on this? It's a little bit like Christianity saying, you know, there has to be a heaven or a hell, otherwise you wouldn't be moral. It's like, well, no, there's other reasons why we might choose to act this way without that overarching idea. So, you know, we don't necessarily need to believe in transmigration in order to follow Buddhism. But in any case, the religious minds of the time became obsessed with understanding the mechanisms of rebirth and how to influence the kinds of circumstances you could expect to experience in your next life. So this was the process of causation. This is karma. Karma means action or deed. So what can you do, or what is it that you do that affects your future? And obviously, you know, what happens to you in this life, but also what happens to you in the next life and the life after that. So some spiritual thinkers, and particularly the Upanishadic ones, also began to conceive of a permanent, timeless state of being that could be attained through rigorous spiritual practice. In other words, escape from the cycle. So then there was also not just, you know, how do you make sure that you have a good rebirth, but how might you break free from the entire cycle? And to raise that up as like something you might want to consider, you know, as a higher goal. So it wasn't just Buddhism that thought of that as, you know, getting off this whole cycle and also aiming for the stilling of whatever it is that drives you into the next life, as opposed to just trying to, you know, set things up so you got really good fortune in the next life. So there was this growth and proliferation of alternative religious sects. And they had these questions. Did the individual transmigrate through multiple lifetimes? If individuals did transmigrate, how could they affect their future rebirths? In other words, was there such a thing as a karma or the law of moral cause and effect? If there was such a thing as karma, how did it work? And what could people do to increase their chances of happiness in future lives? And then 4, assuming both transmigration and karma, is there anything people could do to liberate themselves from the cycle of rebirth entirely? And these may sound philosophical, and I'm sure there were plenty of philosophically minded people debating these things and talking about these things. But, you know, to bring it just down to our everyday lives, this is like what accounts for different people's fortunes? You know, if you're suddenly hit, you and your loved ones are suddenly hit by massive misfortune and sadness and loss. I mean, you may be able to go, okay, this was random, but it's usually nice to be able to take some kind of solace in, like, I don't know, maybe God meant this as a lesson, or maybe it was something that I did, or so actually you can look sometimes at this idea of rebirth as a way to feel more in control of your life, because if this crap is happening to you because of something you did in the past, at least you kind of got an explanation, and then you can try not to do that, and you know, and then your future will be better. So if it kind of, ironically, can kind of give you a sense of agency over life, as opposed to it just seeming random. So I'll just introduce you to a few of the non-Buddhist schools that arose at the time, and some of these were just kind of momentary philosophical, spiritual traditions, but they usually had, like at the time, these were called Shramana traditions, and they often had, you know, it was like a band of men off in the woods meditating and philosophizing and having kind of a set of teachings. So there was more to it than just, you know, philosophizing. There were actually groups. So the materialists, they denied the existence of anything immaterial. Therefore, the individual was annihilated at death. So obviously, I'd say, so they didn't believe in transmigration, but in a way you can see where this was a philosophy in reaction to the theory of transmigration. So this is how that this doctrine impacted all of these schools, even if they said, you know, they took issue with it. So they denied the existence of anything immaterial, were annihilated at death. No immaterial essence can go from life to life and be reborn. No need to worry about future lives, contentment and pleasure in this life. No need to deny yourself anything. Might as well enjoy it while you got it. The Ajivikas, or lifeless ones, I said probably a name applied to them by others, believed in transmigration, but not karma. That is, nothing you did had any effect on the conditions of your rebirth. Everything was determined by an entirely amoral, impersonal, cosmic principles. And it was called niyati, meaning destiny, chance, or nature. So morality was a mere social convention. So the way to peace was simply to accept the course of one's life, because it's all just fate. Now the Jains, the Jain religion exists to this day, and like kind of Jainism and Buddhism, I think, were some of the main, like the ones that grew beyond just a bunch of like long-haired naked men in the woods. They were led by Nigantha Nataputta, later known as Vadamana Mahavira, the great hero. And Mahavira believed in both transmigration and karma, and he had a very unique view of how they operated. So he saw the immaterial life principle or soul, called jiva, is trapped within form, within our bodies. In fact, every material has some spirit or soul trapped within it. So that includes animals, plants, inanimate objects, bodies of water, drops of rain, wind, fire. Everything had some of this jiva enmeshed in it. And karma is an impersonal natural law that keeps the soul captive within matter. So selfish and careless actions generate literally heavy karma. So they generate more of this karma that binds the soul to matter. And causing harm to other living beings causes the heaviest karma of all. And so obviously living beings, but like harm to anything, because right, anything might have jiva attached. So the Jain monks take the practice of non-violence, of non-harming, ahimsa, to extremes. So they adopt practices like eating as little as possible, because everything that you eat, you are destroying something, you are killing something. Sometimes they will wear masks, you might have seen this, that to avoid inhaling insects. Or brushing the ground when they have to walk, so that they, you know, push insects out of the way. Moving slowly so as to minimize violence to the beings of the air. So how do lay Jains practice? Do you have anything to say about that? I was just by thinking, like, because this is kind of the extreme, is, you know, the monastic kind of ideal, but there's lots of lay Jains.
It's like the Buddha, if there is a Buddhist time, that's how the Buddhists practice, right? The lay Buddhists were just providing sustenance to the monks. So they didn't practice the same way as the monks did.
Right, right.
And it's interesting that in India what happened is, because of the caste system, the Jains were the traders. So my people, my community, were the third caste. So there was the priests, the warriors, and then the trader class. Now, they, because of what you said, the social changes, they became really wealthy, because they accumulated wealth. And so now they're wealthy, but they're still not the top class. So a lot of them converted to Jainism. So they didn't have to be the third class. It's really interesting, because the Jains are now one of the most affluent communities in India, right? And yet they are the followers of this ascetic tradition. It's like really strange.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like all of my relatives, you know, they have built all these beautiful marble temples, you know, to Mahavira and all of that. But they're industrialists, and you know, they do all this. I don't understand how they explain to themselves the dichotomy between how they live and what the religion that is.
But that's true. It's the same. It is a very similar thing with Buddhism. There, I mean, it's only very recently that, right, that lay Buddhists have said, "I want to practice this stuff." I mean, there's been occasional ones throughout history, but for the most part, it's only recently that lay people have had the leisure time and freedom to, you know, want to practice themselves. And then, you know, there's the Buddha. He left it all behind. You know, he says, you know, if you're involved in the household life, it's just complicating and stuff like that. So you donate to the monks and you yeah. build temples and yeah. you support
yeah.
you support the religion. Interesting. So the ideal is for the monk to pass away by starving himself, because that is the, I mean, even eating is still a compromise. So what you want to do, oh, and also, so non-selfish actions generate light karma. The karma's lighter, but it's only suffering willingly. It's only ascetic practice that burns off karma. So will ascetic practice, willingly suffering, actually starts burning off the karma, and then starts to like lighten your karma so that when you die, your soul can be freed from your body.
So, you know, when, like even now, if you want to renounce the household life and become a Jain monk, you guys means Buddhists will shave their heads, so they, you know, they'll shave it.
Yeah.
But a Jain monk has to pull out each hair.
Oh,
it still happens.
Wow.
And my mom told me about one occasion where there was this woman who was a Jain nun, was starving herself to death over a period of time, right? So when she was actually going to die, she was on the stage and thousands of Jains came to watch her take her last breath. Because if you could be present at this moment where she's liberating her soul from whatever, mm-hmm. you know, the karma,
yeah.
then you partake of some of that.
Ah.
So she actually watched that. So it can be that ascetic and that rigorous.
Wow.
I don't get it.
So, I mean, in a way, so now you have a little setup of like the Vedic tradition, you have a little setup of the Upanishads and the Jains, and so now I think you might appreciate the Buddhist take. So the Jain and Buddhist views of karma are similar in two respects. Karma is presented as an impersonal natural law of moral cause and effect. So it's like the functioning of karma, you know, nobody has to be in charge of it. It's just a way that things work. And two, selfish and harmful actions are believed to generate negative karma. So, I mean, there's an aspect of morality there of non-harming, you know, has lighter karma, and selfish actions and harm cause negative karma. However, in most other aspects, the view is very different. So, you know, the Buddha, his question that set him on his spiritual quest was about suffering, about is there anything that you could do about suffering? And so, of course, because of the view of the time, he wasn't just talking about the suffering within a given lifetime, but just, you know, lifetime after lifetime. So upon his awakening, what did he wake up to? What did he realize? So according to the story, which he tells in the Pali Canon, he's sitting there and, you know, on the fateful night when it all came together, what he saw was a vision. He was able to see through space and time, and he was able to see countless beings going through this cycle of rebirth. And he was able to observe and see, you know, what was it? What was it that causes this person to, you know, be reborn in unfortunate circumstances? What caused this person to be have good fortune? So he began to see how karma worked. What was it that determined the circumstances of one's situation? And what he noticed was that one's state of mind while committing an action, one's views and intentions, significantly influence the results of that action. What did you mean to do when you committed an action? So one of my favorite scholars, Ajahn Tanisaro, I will let him explain the significance of his realization. So the Bodhisattva's realization in his second insight that karma determines how beings fare in the round of rebirth caused him to focus on the question of karma in his third insight. And because the second insight pointed to right and wrong views as the factors determining the quality of karma, he looked into the possibility that karma was primarily a mental process, not a physical one, as the Vedists and Jains taught. As a result, he focused on the mental karma that was taking place at that very moment in his mind to understand the process more clearly. In particular, he wanted to see if there might be a type of right view that instead of continuing the round of rebirth would bring release from it. So he observed in his own mind, you know, what causes suffering to arise, what allows it to fall away. So it was like this scientific observation of his own direct experience. So he noticed what, you know, that certain kinds of views cause distress and suffering. And if he let go of those views, the suffering went away. So the most distressing and harmful view of all, the Buddha noticed, was the identification of yourself with your body, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, or consciousness. So that's the skandhas. That's basically identifying the self with any aspect of your being. And that was because any aspect of your being is subject to change. It's impermanent. It's not something that you can grasp. So trying to find a self in it causes us no end of stress and suffering. And then he saw how we can practice in order to perceive the truth and shed our wrong views. So out of this came the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So in the Eightfold Path, it begins, but it also like is like a hologram or a, I don't know, it's a circle. You are involved with all aspects of the path at the same time. Well, the two critical aspects are right view, aka right understanding, and that means to really, really perceive and understand directly in your own experience the Four Noble Truths. To really pay attention and see what causes suffering in your own experience. And then the second one is right resolve or right intention. So you have to have the intention then to, when you see it causes suffering, to do something about it. You see it causes suffering, stop doing that. You see it causes suffering, then that's where the spirit of renunciation comes from. It doesn't necessarily have to be renunciation of stuff, but renunciation of what causes suffering. So that's right view and right resolve. Then there's the three kind of moral behavioral aspects of the path: speech, right action, right livelihood. There's right effort, generating desire for liberation. So it's like, even if you had right view and right resolve, if you didn't have right effort, nothing would happen. So you have to put some effort. Right mindfulness is, in this context, doesn't mean what, you know, mindfulness based stress reduction means. It means turning the mind toward what will lead to liberation. So it's paying attention. Like if you were driving, right mindfulness is paying attention to the road. Not paying attention to the sunset, you know. You could be mindfully paying attention to the sunset, but that's not very helpful. So right mindfulness is paying attention to what is going to get you further along the path. And then right concentration or right meditation is the uniquely Buddhist part of observing within. We have to have the ability to really observe within our own minds in order to be able to see that, to develop right view. So the Buddha's how it compares to the other traditions of his time was that emphasis on this is primarily about your mind. And he
wasn't he raised in wealth, and that was disappointing, you know. And he saw people who left his home.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the suffering.
Yeah, so that was his question really, is how do we find some peace in this life, seeing as, you know, the sights that he saw were an old person, a sick person, yes. A dead person.
That's right.
It's like, no matter how much wealth you have, no matter how young you are, no matter how, you know, these things are going to happen.
No, you haul on the back of hers. It's true. Yeah. It's true.
What was your question?
Well, just, no, I just, you know, open it up to any comments or questions about this.
So really, I think it's interesting how, like, as the tradition, like this, like, Indian religion and philosophy had influence on the West, because I know that Schopenhauer, existential philosopher, he was really big on Buddhism, and that's why he, like, pushed for asceticism, I guess, in philosophy. Mm-hmm. He also, a philosopher in Egypt, he had the thought experiment of mor fati, which he got from Indian religions, where, like, they say if some demon or angel came to you and said, oh, you have to repeat this life over and over again, instead of living a good life, would be, if your reaction to that was that you're happy, I get to repeat this life over and over again. And if you're not, then you should change it.
Huh.
So yeah, I think that's interesting.
Interesting.
I influence the West.
Yeah.
Do you think it was directly from, like, East to West, or could it just be... you know, human brains are similar to one another, and they might just kind of come up with the same idea. It's a basic idea. But do we know for sure that Nietzsche was influenced by Eastern?
Yeah, because I know that Schopenhauer read the Upanishads and was big on Buddhism. And so then Nietzsche was a big follower of Schopenhauer, could agree on. But yeah, but I think it was from East to West, and they really, like, agreed. Or the Eastern views really, I guess, like, hit home for them. And they identified it, I guess, transformed into, like, a Western type of mindset.
Yeah, for some reason, the Germans in particular, like, because I know Hermann Hesse wrote Siddhartha.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my first exposure to anything remotely Buddhist, was reading that as a kid.
Don't we die before we die? Is metta teaching?
I don't know.
Letting go of the ego, working, letting go of the ego. Mm. So when we die, it's just our bodies. That's what I've been taught. We die before we die.
I haven't heard it put that way exactly.
How would you put it?
Is it dying or is it being reborn when you let go of your ego?
No, I would. I guess I mean, it might just be different language used by different traditions. I would. I mean, from the Zen point of view, seeing the emptiness of the self.
There we go.
And
right.
And letting go of attachment.
Yes.
Or identification with it.
Yes.
So then you just. Whatever happens, happens next.
So we're dying to all that. Yeah.
Isn't that kind of like letting a delusion die? Isn't that the basic idea? Or letting, releasing or letting go of a delusion? it's like a mental construct. It's not your continuing self. It's a mental construct. It's not actually real, so to speak.
So does anybody find it challenging that the Buddha looked at the issue of suffering and how do you improve your lot in this life or maybe the next and said it's all a matter of your mind? I mean, life can be tough. I mean, you're still facing old age, disease, and death. You're still facing loss. You're still facing injustice. You're still facing... So in a way, what does it mean that karma is primarily a mental process?
Isn't suffering just basically the distance between where you are and where you want to be? And so it's hard to control where you are, but it's easier with your mind to control where you want to be. You can align where you want to be with where you are. It's like being in the moment. And that, my understanding is that's, if not it, at least a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I always think about like the difference between pain, which everybody feels, and suffering, which is sort of like throwing kerosene on the fire, or gas, or whatever. And I think that second thing is what the Buddha is talking about.
Suffering is attachment to what you would hope to have come. Pain, you suffer because you wish you didn't. You wish to be pain free. This is a delusion. There is no pain free. And so you get caught up in that cycle of, why is this happening? So you suffer even though this is to be expected. This is part of the human life.
And yet, easier said than done.
Why it's practice.
Which is why, I mean, it's the only reason that I think I probably would have admired Buddhism, just like I admired Henry David Thoreau and the Stoics, but they didn't give me a path for what to do. How do you do that? But Buddhism has a lot. If you want, it's not so easy to accept or to see things clearly. To let go to. But here's some things you can try.
Whole concept of dropping your attachments to outcome, to losing your attachments, it's a good tool. Even if you are not good at least understanding, is a bit of a step down the path of no suffering. Perhaps if there is reincarnation, don't just start over, but maybe start where we left off.
Well, that's the whole theory with the Vajrayana folks, right? If you get a real spiritual adept, then you can direct where you go, and you don't forget everything, and you keep going. So people like the Dalai Lama are supposedly rebirths of spiritual adepts.
Was there Zen Buddhism that started after Buddha?
Yeah, in China.
Yeah, in China.
Yeah, so it went...
And there's a difference. Yeah. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's okay. Five lectures.
I think that was my first podcast episode. How does Zen Buddhism relate to Buddhism? I don't know. It's kind of, I think of it kind of like a tree, there's the trunk is kind of original Buddhism, and then, you have Vajrayana and Zen and other Mahayana traditions over here, and Well, I mean, to summarize it in like a couple sentences.
It's not a 5 or 9.
What's the essence of what makes Zen different? I think the biggest thing is, and this is, I mean, part of this is Mahayana, not just Zen, but this whole branch that really, I feel like it was like a radical interpretation of the Buddha's teachings, which said, this isn't just a gradual practice that you do to gradually give up attachment until, you know, you attain this level of, you know, there's different levels in original Buddhism. Like, you're going to be reborn a couple more times, but then you'll get it. You know, and then you're going to be reborn one more time, or you won't be reborn again, or you'll, you know, like, so there's very specific levels of spiritual attainment. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, you know, you won't be, when you die, you know, you won't be reborn. And that's the goal. And, you know, you enter Nirvana. And the Mahayana said, Nirvana is right here. Thinking that it's separate is what causes the suffering.
Yes. Yep.
So therefore, in a way, Nirvana can be right here,
mm-hmm.
right now. However, it's not something you keep. It's not something you like, oh, I've got it now. Now I'm like permanently in Nirvana and everything's great. It's so there's like enlightened moments,
mm-hmm.
not enlightened, you know, people or states that are permanent. So if your desire is for things to be other than how they are, including I don't want to be this deluded person, well, you can drop that desire. And so, I mean, it's still not easy. The ironic thing is it's still not easy to do, is it? But that's what we go for.
I think in one of the podcasts you had said that's been helpful to me is that mind states don't last and that they change and they're not to be relied on. And that's something that's been helpful and something that's been part of my, as a term student, looking at that in my mind states. And that's really been helpful. And I think that was in a more recent podcast.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned what's hard to do, but it's effortless. You know, we don't want to get into spiritual materialism. You understand me? This is not about effort.
See? That's the paradox, isn't
yes,
it? It's kind of like, I don't know.
I've been trying all my life, and I finally learned that.
The effort of non-effort, letting go, but, you know...
Yeah. Yeah,
I remember asking my teacher once, like, well, you know, kind of like, well, if we have everything we need and whatever, then I guess maybe I shouldn't go off and be a monk and whatever. I mean, what is all this about? And she threw me a pillow and she said, catch the Buddha. And I caught the pillow and she said, did you catch the Buddha? And I'm like, no. And she said, well, then you have more work to do. You know, it's like...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It takes a while to uncover ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? I think Jinryu has a quote by a jazz musician at the bottom
Miles
of her
Davis.
Emails. Miles Davis. Man, what? Sometimes it takes you a long time to sound like yourself.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to a Norman Fisher talk, and I only listened to the beginning, but he said his favorite Sunri Suzuki quote is, when you are you, then Buddhism is Buddhism.
Nice. Well, on that, thank you very
much.
Thank
you.